we have seen the emergence of a new black middle class, but all of that in the midst of massive levels of unemployment. Mm. We have come to the end of a certain moral moment, which was carried through, which helped us to overcome apartheid as a legislated form of racism, which doesn't mean that racism has totally disappeared in everyday practice. Let's just look around us and the world in which we live. Well, most countries, including so-called developed countries, are almost on the throes of a civil war.
Spread the fire. Welcome back to SMWX. And today I am honored to be joined by one of the world's preeminent minds, Professor Achille Mbembe, from his books like On the Post-Colony to Necropolitics, Brutalism, Essays Out of the Darkness of Night, to his very well-renowned public lectures and his engagement with the questions of our time. This is one of the interviews I've been most looking forward to. Achille, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
We are going to have a two-part conversation, and the second part will be over on the channel of your new foundation. So do look out for that, viewers. But this conversation we want to center more on South Africa. And can I start with some of the interventions you've made on South Africa from about a decade ago? You haven't intervened much on the country recently. You were talking a lot then about 20 years into democracy, the extent to which forms of racism had been able to persist despite important democratic gains. And you were reflecting on apartheid's futures as well. I wonder, 10 years later and 30 years into South Africa's democracy, what you make of this project that we have all been living through over the last three decades?
Look, first of all, as my bias, I do believe that something happened here in South Africa at the closing of the 20th century, which is of significance for this country, for our continent, and for the world at large. And that, to some extent, the work of teasing out the meaning of that event is not over. It's not over, especially when we look at what's going on in our world today, the ways in which it's a very fractured world, facing very serious challenges, the resurfacing of wars of extermination, which, as we know, historically have been articulated around the traumatic process of racialization, turning other human beings into racial bodies. The kind of technological escalation which we are witnessing with all the artifacts which saturate our daily existence, and which, contrary to what we would have thought, are somewhat debilitating our critical faculties and making us, therefore, amenable to all kinds of manipulations. And then, of course, the biggest threat of all, which is the impending ecological catastrophe, all of which, I think, put back onto our human agenda the question of the sustainability of life on Earth. And it seems to me that at the closing of the 20th century, South Africa opened up a space to think anew those horizons having to do with futures of life, futures of reason, of freedom,
and
the ways in which we could finally disentangle the historical nexus between substantive democracy on the one hand and necropolitics on the other hand, which means the capacity to basically put masses of people to death, people identified as mortal enemies. So how it is that we can reopen a space for a politics of hope and possibility? So it seems to me that that horizon, that project is still with us. I think that in that sense, South Africa is a prime example which we should keep working on. Of course, 30 years later, when we move from that, let's see, theoretical level to more empirical politics of everyday life, 30 years later, things haven't really gone the way we hoped they would, for all kinds of reasons. Of course, we have seen the emergence of a new black middle class, but all of that in the midst of massive levels of unemployment and basically the making superfluous of millions of people. We have also been confronted to some of what happens to former liberation movements, usually 20, 30 years after liberation, when they turn their back to what propelled them in the first instance, the thirst for freedom, and they become preoccupied with the reproduction of power for its own sake. Which translates, of course, into what we call here state capture, high levels of corruption, and as Fanon rightly put it, the emergence of forms of xenophobia, which betray a lot of what utopian horizons channeled the struggle in the first instance. So it seems to me that's where we are right now, in the cracks, in between. We are in this gap between the ideal and its translation in people's everyday life.
You've intervened very powerfully and conclusively about 10 years ago as well on the racial polarization that still continues to characterize South Africa. But interestingly, and maybe paradoxically as well, unlike some of those who've launched that critique on South Africa's current situation and its failure to translate the democratic project fully, you've also insisted that we really need to go back and take a look at what was happening in 1994 and in the project of reconciliation, which in some ways has been, you know, stylized now and has been dismissed because of from the present historical vantage point. But you have argued that we need to rescue something of that moment which has got lost over the last 30 years. Why do you think we have in some ways forgotten what that moment represented, or at least could still represent?
I think we have tended to dismiss that moment or to forget it, partly because of a lack of a deep historical consciousness. We think and we tend to act as if our history was very recent. either recently started not so long ago, or when we try to look at it from the perspective of a longer jury, long time, we tend to reduce it to one event, the arrival of Jan van Riebeeck on our shores, an event which is somewhat devoid of its own complex historical texture. So it seems to me that that kind of presentism, the idea that time begins with us and somewhat ends with us too, is at the source of the shortness of foresight that we are witnessing right now. The fact that the former liberation movement has, if you want, run out of ideas, is no longer really, as far as I can see, I may be mistaken, is no longer able to produce any future-oriented proposal about this place and its place in the world and in the continent. So it seems to me that that moment of sterility, absence of fertility, is also the result of a lack of moral imagination. We have come to the end of a certain moral moment, which was carried through, which helped us to overcome apartheid as a legislated form of racism, which doesn't mean that racism has totally disappeared in everyday practice. But this country is no longer legislated, let's say, under the rule of race, if you want. Racism is still there. It has mutated. And it is in the power of racism, indeed, to always exceed political forms, in the sense that democracy as such doesn't, in any case, liberal democracy does not signal its end, nor, by the way, forms of autocracy. So it always exceeds, let's say, the political form in which it finds its manifestation. So we need something else in order to uproot it. So those are two reasons, it seems to me, why, let's say, we seem to be stuck as we speak.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does seem that there was an important political, philosophical project in the thrust towards reconciliation, which maybe was the wrong term. But there was, at its core, an important moral and political project which maybe has become shipwrecked, but maybe that we still need to revisit now, even as calls for more forms of obvious reparatory justice and even retribution seem to be rising. There was something important philosophically in that project that maybe has become obscured from view in the present.
Oh, definitely. Because, I mean, let's just look around us, the world in which we live. Well, most countries, including so-called developed countries, are almost on the throes of a civil war. Polarization has reached very extreme levels. Take the United States of America, for instance, or the emergence of populist politics, most of them racist and xenophobic, in Western Europe, expansion and proliferation of right-wing forms of extremisms. or take a number of situations of conflict. Of course, Ukraine and Russia, what's going on in the Middle East, or even in some parts of our own continent in Africa. What we hear is, don't speak to the enemy. Negotiation as such is seen as you negotiate, you look like a weak person. Every force wants to appear to be strong. Calls here and there of for the brutalization of the weak, the weakest amongst us. A kind of virilism in politics and geopolitics, which, when added up to the key challenges I was referring to early on, leads to where I'm not sure they lead anyway. The politics of vengeance and so if they lead nowhere except to further conflict and further spilling of blood, then isn't it necessary to begin thinking of different ways of inhabiting the earth and different ways, more durable, to sustain collective existence and life in common, which is the real name of democracy. And in that sense, if this is urgent, it seems to me that then what we tried to do here in South Africa 30 years ago merits more than just sheer disqualification. We have to look into it anew and re-engineer new ways in which we will deal with those perennial questions. What do we do with our enemies? How do we treat the stranger and the migrant in our midst? How is it that we recreate the environments and the conditions which allow us to make of democracy a real community of life, as opposed to just a procedural technology of apportionment of an allocation of raw power? Those questions are with us, and we really need to deal with them deeply.
You wrote a really interesting piece in the Mail and Guardian again 10 years ago, after which you decided you're not talking about South Africa again, which I still go back to now, because there's been a very frenzied response to the EFF ever since its origin and ever since its appearance on the scene. And you said back then that it was, quote, the most intriguing, if controversial, attempt to create a political movement post-apartheid. How do you look at the EFF with 10 years of hindsight? And what do you think it represents and characterizes in South African politics right now?
I haven't been making pronouncements on South African politics as such, but South Africa is deeply in my heart. I mean, whatever I have written over the last 20 or so years has been deeply shaped by this experience and my life here. And I think I will die here. I'm not going anywhere. So it's not a way of disavowing anything. Certainly not this country and its people.
Sure.
Now you ask me about the EFF. I have followed the EFF intermittently, not as a real observer. I did follow it when it was when it emerged. I had some of my students in the movement with whom I kept talking to over a very long time. It looks, seen from afar, as if the movement has undergone a certain form of normalization, in the sense that it does no longer exhibit the kind of edge it used to when it was, when it first emerged. Seeing this once again, I'm not really privy to the internal debates within the EFF. I notice the extent to which its references to the continent are still there, although here and there there seems to be a form of fascination. I don't really want to be unfair to the movement. I think I'll stop there.
No, absolutely. I suppose lastly, before we move on to part two of our conversation, looking more at the continent, on the Foundation's YouTube page, what do you think this election coming up represents, and what do you make of the election in South Africa's story of democracy?
The first election after apartheid had been abolished was a major event. You were showing me the some of the paraphernalia.
Why?
Doing the T-shirt of Advocate Mpofu. And I was saying, oh, this was a time of possibility. And feeling was that a historical threshold has been, reached and transcended. And new horizons of hope were being opened up. The next election does not have that significance. It has a, which doesn't mean that it is meaningless. No election in a democratic system is meaningless. But the next election seems to me to be, to represent somewhat the last song of a dream that has petered out, whether the ANC wins it or not. I have a hard time personally observing here and there signs of this great movement re-emerging out of the ashes. In any case, not in terms of new ideas. And yet, the overall landscape doesn't seem to be that creative neither, in the sense that the DA, for instance, has basically renounced to the possibility of becoming a governing party, in the sense that the DA seems to be happy exercising its role in the Western Cape and maybe in some coastal enclaves, and has turned its back to the hinterland. then we have a terrible political fragmentation, and the emergence and multiplication of small parties, none of which seems to be able to construct a counter-hegemony in relation to what the ANC has represented. And yet the imaginary of the struggle for liberation is still extremely powerful, seems to me, and in spite of the fact that the country nowadays is full of a younger generation, people for whom apartheid is, but really they never went through it, actually. So it's a long moment of transition, which hopefully should result in a deep recomposition of political forces. But this won't happen without new ideas. And it's the dearth of these new ideas that strikes me the most. I think the crisis is there. It's a crisis of ideas and of new forms of intellectuality which would help to regenerate the political sphere. But that regeneration of the political sphere won't happen if in the fields of the arts, of culture and aesthetics, a similar revolution doesn't take place. So the question is, how will we invest anew in the production of powerful ideas which speak not only to us, but to the rest of the continent to which we belong and to the world at large, which have significance for a world at large, which is, as I was saying early on, stuck. It seems to me that is where the historical challenge lies.
And as we close off this conversation, and finally, I suppose one of the key places you would expect those new ideas and those new forms of imagination to emerge would be the South African University. And of course, the South African University went through a great period of upheaval between around 2013 to 2018-19, just before the outbreak of COVID, maybe, let's say. This is not to say the South African University hasn't always been in a state of upheaval, but there was a particular moment around the decolonization of the university, and it seemed as though new ideas in some way were trying to break through, to the extent that they were new, even though they were focusing on some old thinkers. And yet now we appear to be in a place, I'm actually quite surprised that the South African University hasn't really occupied the public mind much in the last few months. Maybe that will change. You know, there have been a few protests, but nothing on the scale that we saw. What are your thoughts on where the South African University is right now, contrasting it with, you know, that moment of uprising in some way around which so much of your thought was so central and important?
We are absolutely privileged in South Africa for having created a university space which is free. I have lived in a number of places and I have taught in many universities in the world. I have to say that very seldom have I witnessed the level of academic freedom we enjoy here. So one would expect, in virtue of that privileged position the institution holds, one would expect it to be matched by a similar capacity for innovation and for carrying in its work, academic and non-academic, some of the key issues of our times. It is a bit like that, although not highly visible in a number of areas. So maybe one of the problems has to do with how is it that we make visible a lot of that work which is actually going on, which places a number of South African universities among the key research universities in our continent and in the Global South. So how do we make that work visible? And how do we translate the intelligence that is produced within this space, translate it into public intelligence available and capable of shaping public discussions? That's where the kind of work you do, you and other intellectuals do, becomes really important.
Sure.
The other thing I have to say is that for our universities and our students, our youth, and our intellectuals, our artists, to be able to re-enchant the public space, public sphere, sphere of debate, deliberation, discussion, we need to take the complexities of South African history a bit more seriously. I think that we depend too much on theories and concepts and categories which have been developed in the African-American context. As we were discussing before coming here, in modern history, there have been three crucibles of race and racism: the United States of America, Brazil, and South Africa. As we know, because of U.S. global reach and global power, the American experience of racism or racialization has taken the first seat in what should be a global debate on the multiple trajectories of racism in the world, at the exclusion of the Brazilian and the South African case. So today, a lot of our young people depend almost entirely on Afro-pessimism coming from the U.S., knowing full well that the U.S. is not South Africa. Our reality here, our history here is not exactly the same, although, of course, the space for comparison, modern forms of racism did sustain each other in order for them to endure, to sustain themselves over time. But we need to engage in that difficult work of producing key ideas that can travel from our own experience, rather than borrowing them in a kind of mimetic act, which makes us believe that South Africa is an empty place when it comes to ideas. That's not true. So it's a challenge I put forward, that decolonization will mean something if it helps us to recover that capacity and if we are able to expand the concept of decolonization itself in order to apply it to many other domains beyond, let's say, purely institutional politics.
Well, Ashiel Mbembe, thank you so much for joining us on SMWX. It was a great pleasure and privilege to have you.
Thanks so much, Izwi. Thank you.
And we continue this conversation on the FIDEMO YouTube channel. Have a look at our conversation over there, because we're going to expand beyond South Africa and look at questions of democracy on the African continent. It's a wonderful place where you can get more debate, insight, and discussion around questions of African democracy. And we'll leave the link down below to the second part of our conversation. See you there. Aye.